Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles with me, Robin Allender.
And my name is Jack Pelling.
How are you diddling?
I'm all right, yeah. I've had a very busy week. Cool. And all is well.
It was someone's birthday, I think.
It was my birthday, yes.
Brian Epstein's birthday the other day, wasn't it?
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, well, yeah. But no, happy birthday, mate. No, that's great.
Has he got the same birthday as me?
19th?
No, so yeah, I'm the 16th. So.
Okay, cool.
There we go.
Yeah.
Classic Virgo.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
I don't know. Well, happy birthday, Brian. Anyway.
One thing that has changed quite dramatically in my life over from doing this podcast is the amount of Beatles tat that I get around my birthday. And I feel a little bit like Ringo, but do feel free not to give me Beatles tat. Next to you. No, I'm joking. I absolutely love the Beatles tat. I've got Beatles Monopoly. I've got a rubber duck dressed as Paul from Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I've got, I got an Abbey Road jigsaw for Christmas, and I loved it.
Well, I mean, that is a superb present.
I mean, there's a lot of sky.
Yeah, there is a lot of sky and a lot of very dark trees. Mm. And also my copy of it had a piece missing, which was incredibly frustrating when I finished it. I think we might talk about that in episode one.
Yeah.
Talking of going back to the beginning, we've got an email here from Adam Walden, who says, "Good afternoon, Jack and Robin. I've recently discovered your podcast through Robin's Moon Underwater pod, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it," he says. "I'm working my way up from Ep 1 and was just listening to your episode with Jen Roberts and Kevin Eldon. Your conversation about rutling Beatles songs, in inverted commas, that's the verb to rattle, jogged my memory to a Beatles pastiche done by comedy legend Peter Serafinowicz."
Oh, yes, this is great.
Who I've always wanted to get on this, if you're listening, Peter.
It's got Sarah Pascoe in that video. It's I Will, isn't it? It's a parody of I Will.
I mean, he's done a lot of Beatles stuff. Yeah. So the one that he's referring to here, he says, "You may have heard this before, but if you haven't, I would strongly recommend giving it a full listen. He nails the voice, sound effects, and those lovely lines that deliberately break the rhyming conventions at the end of each phrase. A superb bit of business. Lovely. Anyway, must get back to work. Thanks for all the top quality Beatles chat." But the one that he's talking about is the one where... it's the middle section of A Day in the Life.
Ah,
but,
right.
But at the point where he gets off the bus, it just carries on and describes the whole rest of his day.
That's
it's 20
great.
Minutes long.
That's amazing.
Which that's I heard, really it was on, good. Yeah, I heard it on another podcast relatively recently. That sort of one where American nerds fawn over each other's podcasts. I can't remember what it's called. The Sycophant Cast or something. But that's definitely worth...
sure, listen to that. The I Will one as well is very, very funny as well.
See, I don't know if I know that.
Oh, it's very good.
But that's he used to do a section called Ringo Remembers on his sketch show, which is absolutely brilliant, and he nails every single one of them.
Yeah.
Never seen anyone do all four of them so perfectly.
Yeah. Speaking of Moon Underwater, I did a live performance of the Moon Underwater podcast last night in Chiswick, and there were two personal Beatles fans who came along and said hi after, which was Joss and Rufus. So it was really nice to meet you both, and thanks for coming along and, you know, just generally assuaging the anxiety I have about this podcast, which is great. Really nice folks. Yeah.
I'm coming down to the Moon Underwater for the first time this Sunday.
Ah,
so
brilliant.
Maybe see you there.
Yes, well, you'll see me there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll get my money back. and talking about the people that have been getting in touch, I know last week in our episode with John Bradley, we talked about one of the original things in our first episode, which was the CIA conspiracy theory of the Beatles not existing. And a few people... got in touch to ask if we had heard the podcast Wind of Change,
yeah,
which is about the sort of 80s hair metal German band who apparently the CEO, I won't give anything away, but exactly what we said about the Beatles, where it was an exercise in sort of soft power that helped bring down the Berlin Wall with power ballads.
Scorpions,
and it's really fascinating.
Wind of
the
Change.
Scorpions, I'm a few episodes into that, so
amazing.
Thanks to everyone who sent it to us. It really goes down some good rabbit holes. It's a little bit like, you know, those American podcasts are like, so it's Tuesday and I'm in a diner with, let's call him Oliver, sort of thing, which is, can be a little bit great. But once you get used to that, it's really weird. So, and thank you to long-term listeners Desmond and Molly, the aptly named Desmond and Molly, who sent me that.
They also sent me
a baby, so congratulations. We heard about their wedding last year. So, yeah, thank you very much for everyone who's got in touch. If you want to get in touch with us to share your personal Beatles or bring anything to our attention, you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact or just drop me an email, why don't you, at jack@homespunsounds.com or write us a 5-star review, which is a really nice way to get in touch because, you know, it's good for the old ratings. So thank you very much for all of those, and we'll crack on with this week's episode, which is a sort of another podcast collab, as the kids say, that we're dropping with the Beatles Books podcast with Joe Wisby.
Yeah, brilliant chat with Joe. He's just such a lovely bloke and such a nice presence online, and he wears his very, very extensive learning very lightly. He's so knowledgeable, but he's so interesting to talk to, and obviously knows a great deal about the books. And so it's just really interesting to talk about how the narrative has changed, different perspectives on books, kind of some of the stranger books he's come across, and some of the kind of classic ones. We obviously touch on Revolution in the Head and Tune In and Beatles 66 by Steve Turner, which is a brilliant book, and Many Years From Now. Get your reading list and enjoy.
Yes, we'll post the bibliography of recommended further reading, and go and check them out, because he's if anyone can recommend Beatles books, it's him.
Yeah,
he's probably read more than anyone literally on the planet. And he is a fantastic guy.
So, guys, very funny.
We'll crack on with that in a second. But you had something to chat about.
Yeah,
musically.
Musical stuff.
Go get the guitar, Robin. For
get the guitar.
God's sake.
Well, you know, last week, there's this whole thing we were talking about key changes, right? And last week, I kept saying chord change, and I meant key change. Sorry about that. But someone pointed out that Penny Lane has got a brilliant key change in. And Penny Lane is a song that I'd never really stopped to work out before. And it is extremely ingenious. Can you play it on the piano?
Yeah, I can,
Because it's clearly written on the piano, because it's really hard to kind of arrange for guitar.
Yeah.
So basically, the verses are in B, and then the chorus, it kind of goes down to A. But then the great thing is the key change at the end, there's another chorus, but that goes to B, back up to B.
Yeah.
So it kind of hits that home key in a really peculiar way.
And it's a really interesting one, furthering on from what we were talking about with Laura Barton, about the different characters of keys as well.
Yeah.
Because it's a very sort of sunny song, this, and that character of B major having all those sharps in them.
It's sunny and rainy, appropriately for Penny Lane, I would say, because
the
great thing is, so I found the best way to play it on the guitar is you play it in the key of D, because you can get the walking bass in it a bit more than you know, goes to that minor. But the great thing is with that song is he's kind of using the classic 50s chord progression, you know, the kind of
dream.
But then the great thing is he obviously goes to that minor chord,
and then you've got a nice chromatic
the chromatic thing down. But the funny thing is he's almost acting as if he's still in the major, because the note he goes down to is that it's such a weird chord,
and then you get that really nice suspension that then brings you into
A
major, which is really, it's really weird.
It's brilliant.
Shall I have a bash at playing it on the piano?
Yeah, go for it, mate.
No pedal, which is always very common with Paul. But he stays, but the strange thing about it is that bass carries on down the octave. So it kind of starts on the B, which is the root of that B major.
I Yeah.
Which brings you to E, which is, as anyone who's done the Grey 5 theory knows,
takes you nicely
up
to
Dominant Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a really weird little, and that transition into E, and then as you say, that A then modulates up a tone back into the home key of B major, which is really weird.
I mean, the way he goes to the minor is so classic McCartney. He does a similar thing in Fool on the Hill. But it is like he's literally taking it. This is bouncy, this is nice, and it's like literally, he's almost doing the same thing, but he's kind of gone through the looking glass, and you're in the kind of, you know. It's so weird and strange.
And it really sparkles as well.
Mm.
It's a brilliant and really unconventional bit of songwriting.
Yeah.
Sums up, what we were talking about the other day.
Mm.
Anyway, we won't keep you any longer because we've got to crack on with Joe.
Yeah.
And talk about his favourite Beatle books. You can hear an extended version of this podcast, as ever, by going to patreon.com/personalbeatles, where you can get all our other bonus episodes. We've got another fantastic one coming up that we're recording this week, which is going to be really fun. We've got Alan Jono from Series 1 rejoining us to watch Paul's Give My Regards to Broad Street, which I'll be watching this week.
Yeah.
Having skipped through it, it looks like it might be quite annoyingly good. But we'll see. So for now, please enjoy Joe Wisby of Beatles Books Podcast's Personal Beatles. That's a mouthful.
Welcome to this week's episode of Your Own Personal Beatles, featuring another excellent podcast host. Not that I'm an excellent podcast host, but you get what I mean. Mr. Joe Wisby from the Beatles Books Podcast. Hello.
Hello, one and all. How are you both?
Very well, thank you.
Nice to be here and all that.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure. Joe, your podcast is kind of a process of archiving your Beatles books collection and interviewing various guests about particular books. So how many books have you got in the collection at the moment?
At the moment, the sum total is between 450 and 475. Which I realise is very, very unhealthy in a way. But at the same time, it's just one of those things that kind of grew.
Yeah.
And of course, now that I do the podcast and the Instagram page, they send me free ones.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Amazing.
I mean, it's everything I ever wanted. You know, I just get these random Beatles books dropped through my door roughly once a month.
And have you read all of them cover to cover?
It's a classic question. I'd like to say yes. I've certainly looked at all of them. There are some of them that maybe might arrive in conversation later that I physically couldn't finish because they're obviously terrible.
Right.
But the ones that, I would say 80 to 87% of the books I've got, I've read fully.
That's brilliant. And how did it start then? Like, how did your Beatles journey begin?
Well, it started on June 1992. In fact, I've got the Radio Times behind me from that week, which is another story, which was England played France in Euro 92, and I was eight, and I got into football because of Italia 90, like a lot of people, and I was ready to watch this match on the Sunday afternoon, and they showed Help on ITV before... And that was what kind of got me.
And this was part of the McCartney Is 50 strand, was it?
Yeah. So later that evening, the South Bank show, Sgt. Pepper special was on, which later appears on the Pepper box set. And I'd seen this in the aforementioned Radio Times. And I got my mum to record, because obviously half 10 as an 8-year-old, way past bedtime. So my mum recorded it on a Scotch or something whatever the... some random blank video cassette. And then the next day when I came back from school on the Monday afternoon, I watched this documentary, and that was when I was like, hang on a minute, how could it be those men on a sled on Help be the same as the guys with the moustaches, you know, on top of Abbey Road going crazy? And that was how I fell.
Wow.
When you said your mum recorded it on a Scotch, I thought, for haven't heard that brand name for such a long time, I thought you meant she was drinking whiskey.
She might have been. Who knows?
Yeah. For younger listeners, that's a make of VHS tape.
So was it that... are you saying you weren't particularly impressed with Help, or was it just that Sgt. Pepper, the kind of the change was almost what kind of was amazing for you.
It was that, because, I mean, obviously as an 8-year-old, you're not massively into like the logistics of pop music, but I could realise that they just look, I just recognise that obviously straight away, they look so different.
Mm.
Even in those, that what, you know, under 2 years from Help to, yeah, you know, the all the pictures from that they showed in that documentary of them recording Sgt. Pepper, it just completely bewitched me. And then that weekend, my dad took me to Ottokar's bookshop. This is just old brand names. Ottokar's bookshop, much missed in Brentwood High Street, and bought me my first Beatles book, which was, it's by someone called Arthur Davis, just a basic like picture book,
right?
That just told the story in a very thin kind of way, but that was enough to kind of hook me in.
Yeah.
And then 3 years down the line or so, anthology happens, and it's all over at that point. I'm in.
So, alongside collecting the book, so did you kind of complete the record collection quite soon then, or was it just, or you kind of just filling in the gaps with the books first, or were you kind of getting...
The book, because I'm an only child, I was always a big reader,
yeah,
and I just naturally kind of gravitated toward the books.
Mm.
And even as a kid, well, maybe it was a kind of post-anthology, but even as a kid, I loved the idea of the story.
Yeah.
That first book started with, you know, them as kids, basic kind of, you know, school pictures, and finishes with them. It finishes in like 1991 or something of them. It's like, you know, in the early 90s, bad hair days.
Mm.
And I just love that idea of the story. So obviously I then looked into finding out more of the story,
yeah,
which meant going back into Ottokar's and getting more books.
Yeah.
And I kind of climbed up the ladder from there.
Yeah.
I mean, most of them I bought them all on cassette, the
right,
first, because it was just, we were not a well-off family, so cassettes were the cheaper option, as you both remember.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I kind of built up the collection, starting with the Red and Blue, and then I got I got a CD player for Christmas, the Anthology Christmas '95.
Mm.
So I got like that and Anthology One.
Oh, brilliant!
For my like, I was just turning 12 then in '95.
Yeah.
So, and then obviously I re-bought them all. I paid like $16.99 or something,
yeah,
as you used to pay for CDs.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you see like a charity shop CD and it's got like our price, something $17.99.
I know,
and it's
so
like
expensive.
Best of, it's like Graceland or something,
yeah,
like that.
You're
like,
yeah, God, kids don't know they're born. Yeah, it was hard. So, and you talked about the story, and there's a great episode of yours where you're talking to Andy Miller about the Hunter Davis book. And so in that episode, you kind of say this thing that in many ways, that's the tablet down from the mountain in terms of the first iteration of the story. So
yeah,
how do you feel about that book, the Hunter Davis authorised biography, and how do you feel that's kind of affected subsequent retellings?
Well, one of the points in that episode that Andy made quite brilliantly was that essentially the beats of the story came from that book.
Mm.
Every book on all of our shelves, not every book, but, you know, the majority of the books on all of our shelves take something from that one book.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was rushed out in like 18 months.
Yeah.
You know, but it was just like, you know, it wasn't anything that was poured over. It was just done quickly.
Yeah.
And yeah, the beats of the story. And I think it's, I mean, obviously, yeah, it's sanitized. I mean, the view of it now is it's a sanitized kind of basic version of it. But if you pick it up now, there is some quite stuff that, there's quite a lot in there about Paul and Stuart's falling out in Hamburg and things like that. There's no mention of the music at all.
It barely
talks about the music.
Yeah.
But then that was what was already around. They could hear the music there and then, couldn't they?
It is kind of quite, like, you know, adult in places. There's a great bit where George Harrison says we can't say the F word in songs, but I'm sure we soon will be able to. And it does say the F word in print. You know, and there's stuff like that. And there's also great, like, John talking about the kind of people reading into the lyrics and kind of, you know, we're just writing songs, etc. They don't mean anything. And that's kind of almost looking ahead to the way we have kind of, you know, we do endlessly interpret and reinterpret the songs, and so in many ways it seems very ahead of its time, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it zips along, doesn't it? Mm. You know, there's such an energy to it, which I hadn't really remembered, but I kind of rediscovered when I reread it in preparation for the episode with Andy. Mm. I think it's been rewritten and he's done new introductions several times since that original version. But it captures that weird moment of end of 67. The breakup isn't really on the horizon, but they've done Sergeant Pepper. It's that kind of twiddling the thumbs period.
Yeah.
Between the end of Pepper, Magical Mystery Tour, they've not gone to India yet. It captures that weird kind of, which then was just like another day.
Yeah.
But it captures that quite nicely.
Yeah, before the White Album really is where it's positioned. So it's just such a brilliant snapshot of that exact time.
Yeah.
And when we interviewed Nish, he mentioned the kind of afterword bit, which was written in the 80s, so after Lennon's death. And that I went and read that after we interviewed him. And that interview with Paul is extraordinary because it just sounds so off the record, doesn't it? It sounds like he's kind of ranting and raving about wanting to put facts right, you know?
Well, I mean, that's interesting because there's... As you might know on the Twitter feed that I do for the podcast, I just post random videos and stuff. And there's because I spend far too much time on YouTube. and if you look at the Paul interviews from how he's changed his interview style, obviously naturally as he's got older, and how I think, you know, there's that thing of, probably can't say quite as much now as you could have done then. But, you know, some of those interviews, like that one for Hunter Davis, the Chris Sadovich one that he does for the first issue of Q, which is really open.
So I became known as being overpowering. So I think it was Abbey Road we were doing, yeah, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, because I got some grief on that. I took three days to do that. Yeah. Now you know how long Trevor Horn takes to do a mix for Frankie. Sure. You know, so that's the strange thing. I feel vindicated as time goes on. I'm beginning to understand what I was doing and that it was half of it was as innocent as I thought it was.
He was so... I mean, that might lead into talking about many years from now, because... I think he felt so... He had this thing where John had kind of dominated that narrative from the 70s. So he does that Rolling Stone interview and, you know, plays the press a bit better. And John kind of fits in with that 70s moment a bit better, certainly in the early part of the 70s. Then when John is killed and then you get A Shout comes out, which obviously is a massively pro-Lennon book, you can kind of see why Paul must think, well, hang on a minute.
Mm, yeah.
Where's my voice in all of this? I think that interview with Hunter is him voicing the frustration of his perception and the fact that, you know, Johnny's friend's gone, and I think 80s was a tough period in the McCartney decades.
So in terms of like the kind of myths about the Beatles, that Lennon was the kind of more experimental, harder-edged one, and that's the kind of myth that McCartney's very keen to kind of take apart. Where do you think that myth came from? Do you think it came from books like Shout, or do you think it, you know, just came in the wake of Lennon's death, or as you say? Or...
I think it's a combination of things, but I think Shout was a big part of that. Mm. I mean, of course, Shout had started... I think he'd started writing it like end of 78, and it comes out March of 81.
Mm.
And, you know, you've got that thing of... When I worked at HMV, when, like, an actor or a musician died, we used to say to each other, let's do the death Mio. The Mio was the name of the end of the aisle. And people have that natural interest when someone dies of buying that film or that music. So Shout fitted in with that moment perfectly because... Yeah. You know, I mean, if you've reread it recently, that original edition, it savages so much of Paul.
Mm.
So I think Shout was responsible for that, alongside, especially more so in America, Yoko kind of allying herself with Yam Wenner and Rolling Stone magazine, which obviously Rolling Stone had been a big supporter of John's all through the 70s. And then when John is killed, she... Without sounding too cynical, I think there's an element of her and Yan recognising they can keep this myth not it's entirely a myth, but they certainly keep that image of John going.
Yeah.
And if you look through the reviews of Paul's albums through the 80s in Rolling Stone and other magazines, they're not hugely glowing at times. So I think it's a combination of things that contribute to that view of Paul. And of course, the other thing is, after Tug of War, the stuff that Paul was doing in the 80s isn't maybe, things like, you're going to rewatch Broad Street soon, aren't you? You will discover for yourselves what happens in that film. Yeah. But, things like Pipes of Peace and Press, not classics, are they?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think as well that Paul kind of felt he'd suffered because he was, because John was so outspoken and was just happy to slag anything off and just could be so exaggerated. And I think Paul kind of didn't play that part. So when the kind of some of these quite extreme things, Paul says in that Hunter Davis interview about, Yoko said, "No one hurt John like Paul." And Paul was like so hurt by that. And it's partly that kind of thing of like, well, Paul would never say things like that. You know what I mean? Like John could be so, cutting. And in that Hunter interview, he's trying to kind of right some of those wrongs and say, I was hurt by John as well, and
yeah.
What about me? That's just, that's quite extraordinary.
It must have been difficult for him watching that. Well, obviously, it's difficult in the sense that his friend's just been killed.
Mm.
And then for years after that, everywhere he looked, it was John of the Beatles, John's solo career was wonderful. I mean, it must have, I think it took him a long time.
Yeah.
A long time to get past that.
So we basically asked you before this, like, what were your kind of favourite Beatles books? And I think all of the ones you've chosen, well, let's say Beatles 66 and Many Years From Now, both of them do something to kind of write that McCartney myth, don't they?
Yeah.
So is that something that makes them kind of special for you, or favourites?
A little bit. I do. I've always gravitated toward Paul. Mm. I just always have. Even when in the 90s, when John still had that image of, the cool one. Like, Robin, you put up a tweet recently about Off the Ground.
Yeah.
About who bought Paul McCartney's Off the Ground album in 1993.
Yeah.
Can tell you who, my dad.
Really?
Yeah, he loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fine album.
It's really good.
It's a fine album, yeah. But it's interesting, I don't know who was buying that. I don't think anyone of... in their 20s. I don't know how many... If you took a demographic test
No,
can't think it's of definitely peak Radio 2 McCartney, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
And then it's funny that 30 years on, he's kind of pulled that back.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. As in, what do you mean, Jack? Like, as in he's kind of become...
Well, as in he's much more, as an approaching 80, he's much hipper than he was in terms of his stock in 1993.
Yeah. What I think I was saying with that tweet in a way is this idea that we've really moved past the guilty pleasures thing. And, Wings was a joke. It was a joke that Alan Partridge preferred Wings to the Beatles, And in terms of like ABBA and stuff, they were just a joke as well about, cheesy.
Yeah.
And I think, and now we've just totally reassessed all of that music, Carpenters as well. And I think in a way, Paul McCartney, his reassessment is almost part of that. We'd written it off. Elton John as well. So much Elton John was written off as being a bit naff or cheesy. But I think Paul's benefited from the fact that people have just kind of looked past that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think Queen as well.
Yeah.
A bit of a joke in the 90s.
Mm. Yeah.
But I suppose it's also easy to make jokes about those bands when you never actually have to... The people who are making Wings jokes have probably never actually listened to a Wings record in the same way that people make Phil Collins jokes,
yeah,
or whatever. But nowadays, there's no excuse to not like to dislike something when you can listen to it and be like, I can't really feel strongly about this because it's like objectively not awful.
Do you think that part of that is? And I was just thinking about this, this morning almost in thinking about doing this, is in relation to Paul, is this idea that in the 90s, things like the music press and elsewhere, you had that this idea of the lad, that kind of Liam Gallagher type figure.
Yeah.
And then in the noughties, you had that idea of that you know, terrible, like, Jack Daniels swilling leather jacket Pete Doherty type figure, neither of which is Paul.
Yeah.
But now you don't have that. The people that, you know, you've got, like, someone like Harry Styles, who, I mean, he gave an interview where on Howard Stern where he was talking about Paul McCartney, and he said, well, Paul makes sense to him because he's not interested in throwing TVs out of windows and stuff like that. Even that kind of libertines stroke stuff, that looks, some of that stuff looks so old now.
Yeah, that's
true. Some of those interviews with, like, you know, things like Kasabian talking about the birds or whatever. I mean, I know there's a whole other story with them, but, you know, that kind of Johnny Burrell image that was really, remember, was really popular.
It was,
That's gone now, and I think Paul fits in with this moment a lot more than he did in the 90s.
Totally, and I think as well, like, people like Thundercat, you know, talking about Hall & Oates, or, you know, referencing that kind of 80s sound, and, you know, I think the younger demographic now is just a lot, just cares a lot less about labels and was listening to music from all eras, and it's all mixed up together, and yeah, and I think McCartney does fit into that now, as the remix album kind of showed to good effect, I think, that, you know, it's kind of connecting with the right people, definitely.
I think as well, like, in the years since, like, hip-hop has been the predominant pop form, people have a very different attitude to the legacy of music and just, like, the history, like, musicologically. Mm. Everything's up for grabs in the world of hip-hop. You know, if you're Kanye, it doesn't matter if something's cool, or, you know, if you're sampling Earth, Wind and Fire or whatever, because ultimately the music speaks for itself.
Yeah.
So I think with young kids now, like, they don't, if something slaps, it slaps. They don't, they're not remotely bothered if it looks like a bit of a prat on the cover.
Well, I was going to say, do you remember that idea of selling out? Yeah. Oh, man, that band, they've sold out big time.
Yeah, yeah.
You just never have it now, would you?
No. I mean, this is one thing that comes up a lot because we interview a lot of people from our demographic, kind of our generation. And this idea that in the 90s there were some records that you're so ashamed of owning, you know, and you'd hide the CDs away and everything. It's just non-existent now, that kind of real tribalism about musical tastes and things like that.
I remember the moment when I realised that August and Everything After by The Counting Crows was just a fantastic album. I was like, I just want to listen to this for, like, ever. I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. That's one of my friend John's favourite albums as well. The Counting
Great
Crows.
Record. Yeah, great record. Cool. Anyway.
Can't say I'm there yet.
I'm a huge Nick Kershaw fan, and I think he is due a massive critical reappraisal. But anyway, that's for another podcast.
I mean, it's fascinating, actually, in particular, Paul's attitude to the books. He's obviously, like I said, I have seen quite a few interview clips with Paul over the years, and whenever he's asked about books, he never says, do you know what's a great book about the Beatles? He's got no relationship with them at all.
No. I mean, maybe now's a good time to talk about Revolution in the Head then, because Paul's famously not keen on that one. But
if you want something to read over toilet. That's one of the things he said about it.
What's your relationship with that book? Was that, did you get that when it first came out, and was that part of that 90s kind of reassessment for you?
I mean, I got it when I was about 13, so about the second version of it, the post-Anthology version, about 97. And, you know, it's completely of that moment, isn't it? It's completely of that kind of post Anthology. You've got things like Mojo, the magazine that have appeared, where people are much happier to look back on their career, and it fitted in with that moment really well. And I still love it. Mm. I still pick it up and read it. I mean, interestingly, when I did my podcast on that book, and if one of those, I'll probably do other podcasts about that book. Actually, I did that with an author called Chris Power.
Yeah, he's great. I love his books, yeah.
Really, really, really talented author, and it was a really good interview. And I think, and this sort of comes back to you, Robin, in that you retweeted very kindly that my tweet about that. And I think Danny Baker follows you.
I don't know if he does.
Well, anyway, and he then picked up on that tweet and put a snarky comment about, I don't know if you remember seeing that at the time, this is about January this year, and he put a comment, oh, I can't believe that they're even considering dismissing this book. It's a classic. And then I got trolled kind of a very small amount of people. But Revolution Ahead does provoke that reaction in people. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an interesting... I know the Soda Jerker guys often tweet about it because their view of it... I don't know who runs the Twitter account, but they've often said this thing that they think it's led to kind of these kind of almost... As we were talking about with Paul, it's led to these kind of cultural assessments that are almost down in stone. Like, so is Maxwell Silverhammer a bad song, or have we just been listening to Revolution? Is Long, Long, Long a really good song, or is that just the influence of... Revolution in the Head. I think their point is like the opinions are so subjective, the writing is so subjective that they think it's kind of swayed the way people feel about the records in some way.
Maybe, yeah. But that's testament to its power, really.
Yeah,
that's testament to the way that book captured that moment.
Totally. Yeah, I agree. And I think definitely when I was, you know, I must have been about 13, 14. It didn't change the way I felt about records, for sure. Like, I mean, you know, I mean, obviously loved Helter Skelter at the time, but Ian McDonald hates that with a passion, you know. So it's like, yeah, it didn't really change that. But I do see their argument. I think sometimes journalistically certain ideas crop up and you think that's kind of post-Revolution in the Head kind of.
Yeah,
I think it did give me license a bit more to reevaluate certain things as being below par, because you grow up with a sort of romanticized view of the Beatles just being incredible. And if there was a song I didn't like, I'll think, oh, I'll come round to it one day. It didn't really compute that maybe some songs are just actually quite bad. Because he mixes the granular and the sort of very factually, you know, accurate way that it's all information gained from cataloguing numbers at Abbey Road with those very subjective opinions. Sometimes it's easy for you to just sort of get swept along in, you know, a very broad statement that's quite wild. But it definitely made me reassess quite a lot of things that I wasn't... particularly early George songs, which have kind of legitimised the niggles I've always had, that actually I've always thought everything George wrote pre, you know, certainly early half, is pretty poor.
Yeah.
Really?
What's your view of the essay at the beginning?
I love it, yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. It's a superb piece of writing, isn't it? What do you think of that, Joe?
Well, I think... That did come up in the podcast, and we sort of agreed it. That sort of dated a bit more, because that talks about that moment of the baby boomers, and you know, and how that generation changed. Obviously, he was born in 1948, Ian McDonald, so he's completely part of that generation. And I think that obviously that couldn't foresee what would happen with the baby boomers and the way that generation changed.
Yeah.
So I think that's a bit more of its moment. And he's very dismissive of things like dance music, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I remember he calls computer games elaborate fruit machines.
But it's quite weird, his taste, though, because he quotes Marquis Smith in that introduction, doesn't he, if I'm right? And that doesn't seem to be someone who would be particularly in his kind of wheelhouse, the kind of punk post-punk thing. But, you know, who knows? But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a thing with Ian McDonald. It's a bit like someone who says the best Doctor Who was at its best when I happened to be 14. I think that's the thing.
I could certainly see him, if he was still around, outstaying his welcome as a Six Music DJ.
And of course, his other book was about Shostakovich. You know, it's not like some of these authors, which we love, they are Beatle authors. They will write books about the Beatles. It would have been interesting to see where he would have gone you know, Shostakovich, the Beatles is a fair bridge.
Yeah. It's quite daring in its use of musical theory as well for such a widespread. But, you know, it's not sort of alienating, but he doesn't really hold back on the technicalities of things. And you can tell he does have good, you know, sort of the fundamentals are there in terms of his, like, theory and classical knowledge and stuff, yeah.
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 Yeah. I think, I mean, he is just such a brilliant prose stylist. I mean, the Beatles books that I love, that I've read, they do tend to be, have that quality. So much as, you know, obviously Mark Lewisohn is superb. Like, when you think Tune In starts with that line about sometimes there's an ultimate, and you think, that, you know, that I don't think that's a real banger of an opening. Do you know what I mean? Like, as brilliant as he is, and obviously an amazing guy, like,
yeah,
Ian MacDonald does have an incredible prose style, which is, like, almost poetic.
There's a lot more flair to it, certainly.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, yeah.
Lewisohn, as amazing and unprecedented as that book is, it's quite dry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But it's just, it's more of a historical thing. I think I prefer one, you know, which is great, but I also love the books which are more kind of artistic achievements of their own in a way. See if that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm.
Are either of you familiar with the book Tell Me Why by Tim Riley?
No, I don't know that.
So, Tim Riley, future guest on the Books podcast, plug. he wrote a book called Tell Me Why, he's an American author, in 1988. Mm. And that was a book which, incredibly similar to Revolution in the Head, in that it broke down each song. It's even the way it's kind of styled is very similar to, but it's written in a, it hasn't got quite the flair, as you say, of MacDonald's writing, so therefore it's not remembered like Revolution in the Head is remembered. But it's still in print if you want to pick it up. But there aren't many Beatles books that have got that style that the Revolution in the Head has. Maybe that's why it's lasted as long as it has.
Mm. I remember the first time I read it that it was a proper, considering it's broken down in that way, it's a proper page turner as well, because he does sort of, especially this talking about, I mean, it's one of the more problematic bits that we've talked about before, but the way that he describes John's dalliances with acid. I mean, dalliances is quite a sort of understatement. But, definitely it's the most, partly because there is this sort of tacit moral judgment, but also it's the most sort of candid I've read anyone talk about just how destructive and extreme John's behaviour was in 66, 67.
I mean, he makes that comparison to, you've got that Peter Green, Syd Barrett comparison, that, you know, obviously they're, you know, I imagine I'm not experts on either of them, but I know that they, obviously similar kind of generation and age to John, their drug intake led to a big downturn in their creative abilities, which John doesn't really happen with John. John manages to kind of rein it in. To a certain extent. So I think that just when he writes about that, the acid side of things, it was those two people that kind of came in my mind.
What's another of your top five?
Well, shall we talk about Many Years From Now?
Yeah, sure.
Because, I mean, I'm intrigued to see what, Jack, have you read it?
Sadly.
Okay, that's okay. And Robin, you're just starting to read it, or you?
Well, I ordered it after you after we'd had that email, and it came like about 2 days ago, and it is 700 pages. I wrote this on Twitter about, I did like the beginning of the first chapter, which is, I know books need historical context, but the beginning is on the 28th of August, 1207. Because, yeah, she goes into how Liverpool came to be a city and everything. But, no, it's brilliant. And, I've read the opening bit and kind of skimmed through it. And I think, and Barry Miles is such an important figure in that period as well. But it really does so much to kind of rescue McCartney's reputation, as it were.
Well, I think that's clearly what it was set out to do. Mm. And like I said, he'd been so removed from the narrative through the 70s, 80s, and then it starts to come back in the 90s. And again, it's released in 97 at that perfect kind of post-Flaming Pie. Do you remember how popular Flaming Pie was?
Yeah.
I remember seeing him on TFI Friday.
Yeah, yeah.
We talked about that show a few times. It was a big moment.
Oh, have you, really? Right.
With all the TV screens.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And he's... I suppose there's not an equivalent of... I suppose there is. You couldn't imagine him doing The Word in 93 for Off the Ground, can you? I don't know. I can't imagine him doing, like, a youth TV show like that.
Yeah. I think that during the big Beatles renaissance of the 90s, people would have gone crazy about any McCartney record and the fact that it was good.
I think there was almost a feeling of, like... It was now after Oasis. It was almost like McCartney was kind of going back to something slightly more Beatlesy and more kind of.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like a very kind of raw record.
It sounds like a Jeff Lynne record because it is a Jeff Lynne.
Yeah,
but it's got some great. It's got some beautiful songs on it. But yeah, there's definitely a sense that it was McCartney is cool again. Kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think the book ties in with that moment perfectly because, I mean, if you look at the pictures in the spine, it's people like, it's a picture of Stockhausen and a picture of, you know, Luciano Berio. It rams home that idea of him as someone that was, you know, the avant-garde Beatle. Yeah. But the reason it does that is because that's what he was. And that, you know, that cliche of him being in London going out and doing stuff when the rest of them weren't is because that's what he was doing. He saw that moment. I think obviously it's a marital setup as well, but I think he definitely saw that mid-60s swinging London, whatever you want to call it, moment as maybe even as something finite. And he thought, I'm going to go to every play and every gig or every art installation. I'm going to do this and be this person and osmose all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think many years from now captures that really well.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I think, you know, and the thing with John is that we tend to think one thing of him, but he would say one thing one day and another thing.
Yeah.
You know, that there's that, you know, the famous quote, avant-garde is French for bullshit, which John Lennon apparently said. And John Lennon... as being a Dylan fan, but also being highly suspicious of Dylan's oblique lyrics and thinking they were a bit kind of Emperor's New Clothes as well, I think that kind of gets lost because Lennon was often just two people at once, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, we do tend to think of Lennon as being the kind of adventurous one when obviously in that period, particularly 66, you know, McCartney was... the wire reader of his day, for sure. You know, like, he was so interested in what was going on. Yeah.
Without spoiling it too much for either of you, the book doesn't deal with anything after the Beatles, which I think is really interesting.
Right,
It doesn't... It literally ends... I think the last chapter is called... I think there's the chapter last, but one is called John, and it's just obviously deals with that kind of post... Beatles relationship, and then the last chapter is called The 90s, in which it lists like he's doing a classical album and he's making this Fireman album, and you know, it makes sure that the people know what he's up to, essentially.
So you're going through the index looking for Mull of Kintyre and it's like, what?
He's not in there. Not in there. Nothing about Broad Street in there. So, in your research for that episode, steer clear of many years from now, both of you. but it's interesting. There was talk of another volume at the time. There was some conversations about whether we do like a Wings book, which obviously never happened. And Tom Doyle wrote that really good book about the Wings era, Man on the Run, which covered that period. But yeah, it was, at the time, it was sort of dismissed as a book as him kind of feathering his nest a bit. Which I think, because it was still that moment of him being dismissed. Obviously, I don't think as much as he was kind of 10 years previous. But it's just, it's not him. It's not him feathering his nest. It's just facts. It's just what happened. And and he goes through all the Beatles songs. He says, "Well, I wrote this. John wrote this." Yeah. And you know, things that needed to be said. John had the equivalent with that Playboy interview. Thankfully, you know, months before. He was killed. He sat down with Playboy and went through all the Beatles songs as he remembered them then. It really is it's canon, I would say, many years from now.
Right, what's your favourite book?
I mean, that could be a good segue into the Steve Turner book, then, as we're talking about Paul.
Well, what I love about this is I love Steve Turner. I mean, are you both aware of his book, A Hard Day's Right?
Yeah.
That was actually a really important book for me. I remember I bought that book secondhand from Brentwood Library when libraries would like sell off stock. So it's still got, you know, that thing in library books that used to have the little kind of leaf in the front where it was stamped each time. So I could tell you exactly when it was taken out in like 1993.
That's great.
Anyway, I love that book, and he's written written another really good book called The Gospel According to the Beatles, because he's quite a religious guy, Steve Turner, and he kind of took that angle of how they're kind of dealings with religion. But Beatles 66 literally slows down the action, doesn't it? From it starts in December 65, so it sets the scene, and then it takes you on that journey. And if you could sort of do it for every year. 65 is the one year that you couldn't do it for.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's still a lot happening in 65, but all the other years is jam-packed with stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is that real... It's that kind of like the turning point, isn't it? If you think of the band they are when they start 66 and the band that they are when they're recording, you know, Penny Lane and Shelby Fields.
Yeah.
That's the biggest change. If you look at the start of 64 and the end of 64, there's not a huge amount of difference. But the change that they go through that hideous tour in America and in the Philippines and Japan, the writing and recording of Revolver, coming across things like Pet Sounds, John's Bigger Than Jesus stuff, you know, there's so much that happens. And Steve Turner slows this action down and really, really, really interestingly drills down into the detail of it. And I think it's just... I think that's the way that Beatles books are going to go.
Right.
Is that real... Where you find something really specific... And drill down on that. The days of doing the Beatles biography are gone because of the work Mark Lewisohn is doing. Or even like a John Lennon biography or a Paul McCartney biography. There's no room for that now. It's been done.
Yeah.
So now you've got like that the Beatles and Drugs book, which was by Joe Goodwin, which was a really good book. Where you could do a book about. I don't know, like the Paul's drug bust in 1980. Finding specific things like that.
Yeah, which Hunter Davis has really brilliantly calls daft. Which is really funny. He said Paul was being daft, which he was quite daft. But yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think Beatles 66 does that so well. And I mean, I listened to your podcast interview with Steve Turner, and he, the research he had to do is almost like filling in the calendar. Like, you know, Ringo was on holiday here, you know, and you know, Paul was having an affair here, and you don't want to know what they got up to in India, and you know, all this. But one thing that I love about it is, for me, like one of the really important books I read when I was young was Summer of Love, George Martin's book about Sergeant Pepper. Right. And just the way he described that period before Pepper was just so evocative and just like, just so kind of something I wanted to, you know, experience somehow, you know. So Paul being in London, and John being away filming in Spain, and just finally having both of them having a chance to slow down. But I just think particularly something about John being in Spain and writing Strawberry Fields, it's just so, that's just such a brilliant part of the story for me, because you can kind of hear in Strawberry Fields that he's slowed down in terms of he's allowed himself time to, you know, let his mind wander and question himself and kind of, and you can feel the sun in that song as well, you know, and it was recorded in, even though it was recorded in December, you can feel that kind of, that kind of experience of it. So I think that, I mean, I really loved reading that book for that reason, because it does just, you know, dwell on that fantastic period.
I like also the fact that one of the points that Steve made in that interview is they end up playing that last gig in a cage.
Yeah.
You know, they're literally on stage, and they're, if you think about the cavern, when, you know, girls would hand them requests, you know, on bits of paper, scribbled requests, a hastily scribbled note on a bit of paper, and now they're in this, they're literally, you know, probably felt like miles away from the audience.
Yeah.
And that's in 3 years?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you've talked previously about the speed of all of this, and it's a slightly well-worn point.
Yeah.
When you look at it like that, and that's why I think it's a great book at capturing that the chaos of that last tour.
Yeah.
I think if there's a documentary to be made about the Beatles, I'd love to see, it would be on that last tour.
Mm.
I think there's some real, it's got that slightly dark, drama side to it.
And there's a firecracker thrown on stage, and they carried on playing the song. They didn't even stop playing the song. It's absolutely insane.
I think it might be my favourite bit of the anthology, actually, talking about the madness of that tour and stuff, because it was genuine peril involved in those days.
Yeah.
George makes that point that, you know, there's race riots happening. There was something else going on. Mm. It had changed, didn't it, from that. If you look at that 64 footage, even that first tour of 64, but especially that first US visit, it's just dripping with joy.
Mm.
There's just so much happiness and, you know, energy and, yeah, joy surrounding them and the way that they are in the interviews and the press conferences.
Yeah.
And then if you look at some of the press conferences that are in Anthology and some of the other, the 8 Days a Week film, and they're getting asked all these stupid questions about stuff, and you can see they're just so miserable. You know? I mean,
I think that's one thing that Steve Turner captures really well is the kind of press surrounding it. The press were kind of wanting them to fail in a way. It was like, oh, is the bubble burst kind of thing. And B, the music press, as we know it now, in terms of you know, intelligent writing about rock or pop music, just did not have the vocabulary to describe Rubber Soul or Revolver. And that's so fascinating. And basically the kind of Crawdaddy and Rolling Stone kind of came out. You know, the Beatles paved the way for it. Like, you know, I think Steve Turner quotes one of the reviews of it is Revolver, and it's just literally like, And Your Bird Can Sing is a rocking little number. It's just like not engaging with it in any way at all. It's so fascinating. Because, that, you know, that's part of what they did, is completely change the boundaries of rock, and then journalism had to kind of keep up with it, you know.
Yeah. I wonder how they felt about that, whether or not they would, you know, they... But I suppose if that's all they knew, then it wouldn't have maybe, you know, upset or frustrated them in any way.
But
you know, it's like that, some of that Dylan footage from the Don't Look Back and the Eat the Document films. And he's getting, you know, the famous thing when the guy says, there's a photo shoot with Dylan, and the guy says, suck your glasses. He's got like, do you know, and it's just, you just feel like that generation, they were just so far removed from what had come before.
Show me your fingernails, there's a bit where someone's like, ooh, come in.
Excellent Bob Dylan impression. Absolutely, they were just like aliens, weren't they? You know, they didn't know how to deal with them, and the journalistic voices at that time certainly weren't getting, you know, the space, I suppose. And hence, like you say, Rolling Stone and others appear, and that's when you get that kind of... But then out of that, you get that rockist you know, view of writing, which which happened. So it took a while for the music journalism kind of area to find its feet and work out where it was going.
The original review of Sgt. Pepper in the Times is really interesting because it's incredibly effusive and the pretty like, and for something that I've always felt that that's an example of, it was obviously not the norm, but they got it completely right in that. They knew immediately. I mean, it could have just been one particularly good journalist, but if you, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's a big, I think Ian McDonald quotes a large chunk of it, so I kind of sort it out, but it's, they really like put their, put themselves on the line as to like how much of a game changer that was.
Did they say it was a defining moment in 20th century culture? Is that one?
Yeah, that's exactly, that's the phrase, yeah. Imagine writing that on, I mean, to be fair, Pitchfork used that about twice a week, but...
I think all the Be Here Now reviews also mention that phrase. So, it certainly is interesting that the journalistic voices around that time, they were scrabbling for words, weren't they? They just couldn't keep up with it. And you didn't really have that... You know, people weren't interested in the celebrity side of things. Because you had that kind of teen magazine thing, didn't you? Mm. Which obviously is where the in America they picked up the Beatles are bigger than Jesus quote. So you had all of that kind of stuff, but yeah, there was just the intelligent rock writing. Maybe it was out there and we're not aware of it, but it must have been frustrating for them.
I think they probably recruited a few more younger people when they realised that this rock and roll thing was sticking around, because there's something incredibly patronising about even the way that they're fawned over at the beginning is kind of, you know, they've charmed the establishment, but when they've kind of turned on them later on, as you say, examples of that in that Dylan stuff, like... They're sort of, they're bored of that. They're looking for the next story, and they've kind of betrayed the fact that they don't have any real interest in it beyond it being a scoop.
Should we discuss TuneIn?
Or
even Mark Lewisohn as a kind of an entity is interesting. I mean, like, kind of full disclosure, I've had a mutual friend with Mark.
Oh wow!
So I've got to, you know, I've met him several times.
Amazing.
Pre COVID, and yeah, I mean, he's nothing but a very nice, friendly person, a very nice man. And I met him. I remember I went to this talk with my friend Jules. Shout out, Jules, if you're listening. And it was in, I think it was in Whitechapel, and it was it's on SoundCloud, someone recorded it, and it was like a talk about this guy that had done this art installation about the Six Days War and how that compared to the Beatles. And it was, like very, very strange. I'll see if I can find a link and send it to you both. Yeah. Anyway, and he was like at this talk, very small, probably about 30 people in this kind of little gallery in Whitechapel somewhere. And Mark was there, kind of just did his side of things about the Beatles and discussed the Beatles stuff. And then I met him. I had like an evening with him after that with my other friend. And
wow.
He was just a lovely guy. I've emailed him a little bit over the course of doing the podcast. He's got no interest in appearing on it as yet, unfortunately. And hey, who can blame him? I wonder, how do you guys feel about the kind of pressure that he might be feeling at the moment? I mean, this is a long time between books now.
Yeah. Well, I was going to, because we just interviewed John Bradley from Game of Thrones. I was going to say there's kind of a similar thing going on there, isn't there, with the Game of Thrones books?
Yeah.
Because he's taken on such a monumental task. But I saw someone tweeting that there is a potential release date next year for the second one.
No, that was...
Was that
fake news?
Was
fake
it fake news?
Okay. Like Beatles Twitter in overdrive.
Yeah, so no clear idea on the second one. But he's doing... Is it going to be a trilogy, right?
So the idea... Yeah, I think the idea is that he's working on the two of them at once, because from the interview side of things, if he leaves all the people much longer,
yeah,
they're not going to be either around or available to talk. Okay, so I think he's trying to capture as many of those people that he can now, whilst they're, because, you know, as we know, this is a long time ago now, and you know, no one's getting any younger. So I think, yeah, I think from what I can gather from him is that the gap between 2 and 3 will be less,
right?
And that he's sort of piling on the work now to get them both done while he can.
Yeah.
But we'll see. But yeah, I don't know what you guys feel about, you know, whether or not he's gonna. This is almost too much of a gap now. If we're talking 10 years, I don't know.
It's. I mean, it came out nearly 10 years ago, and I've just finished it, so it's kind of. You know, I can wait 5 years because I haven't had to wait 15. But it's a bit like sort of, I don't know, it's a bit like going viral first, being the man who's going to count to 10 million when you've only reached 5 million.
do you think, because the first one ended at such a pivotal point, where do you think the second one will end and the third one begin?
I would imagine that the second one might end at Candlestick Park. Or New Year's Eve 66, or the first day to go and record Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields. I'd imagine it's going to be around that. Because, I mean, I've been to quite a few talks that he's done over the years. He did one where someone asked him about the Beatles' breakup or something, and he said, well, there is a thought of doing a volume 4 about doing up until like 1980, up until John's death and stuff. I mean, I think that I think that might be overreaching a little bit.
Yeah.
If you think he's kind of late 50s now? I'm not sure. Early 60s? I can't remember. I think
he's been involved in the story for such a long time. I mean, he put Passmasters together and all that, didn't he? And so his knowledge is just second to none, isn't it?
No author is perfect, obviously, and there's always ways you can look at his work in a critical light, like any author ever. But for me personally, I feel like he's the right person to be doing this. Part of that for me is because he's not involved in the organisation now. He's through reasons that I think he's outlined in other podcasts. He's not involved in Apple now from about the early noughties. So he's got a bit of distance, so he can be completely independent, but at the same time he's put in those years of actually knowing Paul quite well, etc., and people like Derek Taylor and Neil Aspinall. So I think for me personally, he's the right man to do it.
I think you really get a sense of that in the book, and my sort of, you know, slightly glib comment of it being quite dry is that's just a byproduct of it being very neutral in a way, and I'd much rather have it like that because it does read like a history book more than, and I'm more interested in it than on that level. You know, I'm more into a really sort of, you know, nook and cranny version of the Beatles story more than another opinion piece of.
Yeah, I think this is where we differ, isn't
it? Yeah, no, because when you said that earlier, I thought, actually, that's quite a major turning point for me. And it reminds me of sort of the great biographies, you know, of, you know, like the ones on Lincoln and Churchill and stuff, like, because there's a certain amount of distance which is absolutely paramount to get that right. And you do get the sense that if, well, God willing, these get properly finished, they will be the texts. They can't come soon enough for me, but also I'm very willing to wait.
One thing I wonder about Mark Lewisohn is, because I think Steve Turner deals with this quite well, is dealing with how much of an unreliable narrator Paul is. You know what I mean? Like, Steve Turner has to put that in this introduction. Like, Paul keeps saying this thing happened. It didn't. I've worked with, you know, stuff like that. I heard a brilliant one. I can't remember who told me this, but like, Paul McCartney met Martin Amis in the 80s and said, I wrote Paperback Writer about you. And it's like, Martin Amis' first novel was published in 1973. It's obviously... But, like, so I mean, how do you think Mark Lewisohn deals with that? Because does he still interview Paul or...
No.
No.
No, I think in the... for the first volume, a few emails were exchanged, and Paul kind of gave some, I suppose, technical information about some recording equipment. But I don't, from what I can gather from him and the interviews that he's given, I don't think there's been any involvement on this volume, which I think, you know, there's enough Paul McCartney interviews out there.
Yeah.
And if anyone's skilled enough to work out where the truth is in those interviews, I think Mark Lewisohn is the person to do that. But yeah, you've really got to pick, you've got to find the gold in those interviews. That's a slight bugbear of mine, is that you see on Twitter often, not that I should look at Twitter that much, but you know when, you know, on, it's come up in that 3-2-1 documentary when people will moan about Paul telling the same stories.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Now, I completely understand, and it's just my blind spot for him and the Beatles properly, but like that story that he tells about when he was playing Hey Jude to John, and the movement you need is in your is on your shoulder, which is, and John was like, no, you'll keep that line, which he, and the best telling of that is in the anthology, by the way, which is perfect, the perfect telling of that.
So he feels this sense, very emotional when he sings that line live, and he mentions that, doesn't he?
He said, I know what it means, the movement you need is on your shoulder. It's great, it's kind of... So that was the great thing about Johnny, whereas I would definitely knock that line out. He'd say, it's great. I'd see it through his eyes and go, oh, OK. So that is the sort of line now when I do that song. That's the line when I think of John, you know. Sometimes get a little emotional during that moment, you know.
And I and the thing about that is, yeah, he's told that countless times, and God willing, he'll tell it again at some point. But that's... I just love... maybe it's just me, but I love the familiarity of some of those stories. I got no issue with him repeating those stories in any way, shape or form. And at the same time, when you get a new story, like there's... Have you ever seen the interview that he did with Ronnie Wood in about 2013?
No, I didn't.
Yes, no. I have. Actually,
Have you seen that, Jack? Yeah, so there's an... Ronnie Wood did this... you might remember, Jack. It was like a series of interviews.
It was a YouTube channel thing.
Yeah. And he tells this story about how... It was like Christmas in about 1958, and John had been round to see him, obviously at Paul's house, and then John had walked home. And then the next day, or the few days later, John had seen Paul again and said, on my walk home, there were those people sat on one of your neighbour's front garden. People just sat out there in the middle of the night, and Paul's like, whoa, a bit weird. So anyway, Paul's like walking on his own the following day. He looks past his house that John was, and there was like a nativity scene that someone had put in. But John without the glasses on, and we were like, people sat there. Just a lovely little, really human story.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would never tire of Paul McCartney stories.
Yes. No,
that's my view.
And if you're going to put a bit of variation in, I think you've earned it after spinning... the same yarn for 60 years.
But it's all about context, isn't there? There was a lovely interview you did with Ed O'Brien from Radiohead?
Yeah.
I think it was, yeah. When he, on Instagram, when the remix album came out, and Ed O'Brien had his daughter come along, and his daughter must be kind of 18-ish, and she was just saying how much she loved Let It Be, and Paul did the Let It Be story, you know, about how the inspiration for it was about a dream of this... his mum and everything. And it was so touching and you know, really moving. Like, you know that story, but, you know, he's telling it there for a specific reason or whatever. And, yeah, that was great, you know.
Do you know the one that he didn't tell so much now, but he told loads at the time, is the How the Michael Jackson Bought His Song story?
Oh, yeah.
And he does a slightly worse impression of Michael Jackson each telling. So it starts off as like passable, and by the end, it sounds like Kermit the Frog or something. Yeah. Like, hi, Paul. I'm going to play your songs. Great. Maybe there's a if there's ever a mastermind category of Paul McCartney's familiar stories.
Yeah,
get me there with Clive Myrie or whatever it is. Is it Clive Myrie? It's Clive Myrie. Yeah. Anyway,
that's brilliant. Super. Oh, that's great. So I just before we go, I wondered. What's the kind of... You mentioned there are some terrible books out there. What's the maddest Beatles book you've come across?
Well, what did I post? Oh, the cheese sandwich. You must have seen the cheese sandwich one. Yeah. Did you see that, Jack?
Yeah, I saw it on your Twitter, yeah.
a woman that made John Lennon a cheese sandwich in Liverpool in 1960 And, I mean, there's a bit more about her youth in Liverpool, but she did apparently, allegedly, make John a cheese sandwich in 1960. And that was my... That went on Twitter and that got retweeted by a few big accounts. And I got loads of people saying... And then that led to people saying, I made John Terry a coffee in Ipswich in 2007. Is there a book in that or something?
Yeah,
there's that one, the conspiracy theory ones. Mm. You've got all the Paul is Dead ones, but you've also got the John Lennon one about... I think you might have commented on it, Robin, actually, on the Instagram feed. Mm. The Lennon conspiracy where John sold his soul.
Right, oh, yeah, my God, yeah.
And your comment was from the blurb on the back, I think the word may is doing quite a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah.
So there's that one. There's a Kindle-only sex line of the Beatles, if you want to go deep. No pun intended.
Is that a kind of erotic fan fiction or
no? No, it's just. It's got an inappropriate.
It's a blow by blow account.
It's got an inappropriate cartoon front cover, which doesn't fit because it's got from that kind of like seaside postcard figures on the front of them. But it's not got a physical release. Alas, only on Kindle. I haven't read it myself. But it alleges that it goes into some depth about the comings and goings of the Fab Four.
The the conspiracy theory that John and Paul were lovers as well. I wonder if there's any books about that.
I think it crops up in a few, but I don't think it's ever got itself its own tome.
No,
but who knows what the future will bring?
Yeah,
maybe that'll be next.
Do you have the book that there was the back blurb of a book that went viral on Twitter the other day? Of a similarly sort of tenuous relationship that was it someone's Brian Epstein's secretary.
Yeah.
Have you got that book?
I got that book was a gift from about 2004 from a well-meaning ex-girlfriend's mother.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Oh, bless. Obviously, you know that thing when people say, oh, I like the Beatles, and people used to buy me, you know, from the kindness of her own heart. And Lord knows where she is now. But she bought me that book, and obviously I realised it was hideous. And I've never, I think I flicked through it on the day.
The blurb ends in quite a shocking way.
It says she died horribly and unexpectedly of mad cow disease.
God,
it's a horrible. There is a dark. You know, there is a sort of a dark side to some of this stuff, and that's a good example of just a horrible, horrible cash-in. But yeah, I thought about when that tweet went viral. I thought about trying to find it again, but I've yet to make that particular journey onto the bookshelves to find it again. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, as you can see on the Instagram account, there's just so much out there. Mm. I think there's well over 1,000 that have been published, which I don't think you can say about any other artist.
No. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. And we really have kept you for a long time, but do you have a controversial Beatles opinion? Because this is the question we ask all our guests.
My controversial Beatles opinion might be... Are you ready?
Yeah.
Go for it. my controversial Beatles opinion is the White Album should be one album.
Hooray! Yeah. Another one.
Am I not the first? Oh, are you the
that
other?
That was in episode one, my controversial Beatles opinion.
Okay.
Which I go back and forth on, to be honest, but, you know...
I'm all about. I love brevity. Films that are more than 2 hours. I'm not into. I like. If you've got something to say, get to the point. Make it rhyme. see you later. And I think there is a fair bit of chaff on the White Album. But then some days I'll be listening to it and it's like going into an empty summer house, into a different room or something every day. And it works really well as a double album. Yeah. But I think in the main, I don't think, you know, Wild Honey Pie is going to, you know, people aren't going to miss that. And I think some of George's songs on there, I think Savoy Shuffle and Piggies are two of my least favourite ever Beatles songs. I think there's a slightly grim meanness to both of those songs that just doesn't sit with me, and I don't really listen to that often. Obviously, and of course you had the Everything guy mentioned about While My Guitar Gently Weeps not being his favourite either. Mm. So I think, although I like Long, 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 that White Album for me, trim it. That's my that's my view.
So that was our fascinating chat with lovely man and podcaster Joe Wisby from the Beatles Book podcast, which is obviously available now on all good podcasting services. So go and check it out.
Yeah, definitely check it out, and definitely follow Joe at Beatles Books on Instagram and Twitter, because he posts a lot of excellent Beatles content.
Yeah, no, he's top drawer. He's a real sort of force for good on Twitter, which can be quite a sort of nasty place at the best of times. So, thank you so much for joining us. And
sorry, at Books Beatles.
At Books Beatles. Okay, yeah. Let's clear that up. if you want to hear an extended version of that chat, if you're not a Patreon subscriber, you can join the gang by going to patreon.com/personalbeatles. And if you enjoyed the show, please do give us a 5-star rating on Apple Music or whatever it's called now, iTunes, MySpace. What is it called now? Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts.
That's really helpful, and it helps other people find the show and stuff. So we're very, very grateful. So next week, we're going to have a week off, actually. And we will be back in 2 Tuesdays' time with another fantastic episode to sort of round off the run, really. We've only got a few left, but some really amazing people. So hopefully see you then.
Keep on beetling.
Keep beetling on.
Keep beetling on. Sorry, is that our catchphrase?
It is now, yeah, why not?
Keep on beetling or keep beetling
on? I think
on.
Last week I said keep beetling on.
Keep beetling on.
But why don't we change it up? We should have a different catchphrase for every show.
Both good phrases.
Yeah, love it. Cheers, cool. Robin. See you next week.
Yeah, cheers, Jack. Bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.